Hi, this is Alan Cobb, and you're listening to Icon Art Radio. I'm here with Bill Teeple and our guest, Greg Thatcher. And we're talking about all kinds of things, but today we're going to pursue the topic of the teaching of art. And in particular, I think some of the ways in which art teaching is outside the classroom and all the different dimensions of art education. We sometimes think of art as being training, art teaching as being training someone in a particular technique, how to use a sable brush or how to make a watercolor. But ultimately, there's an ongoing process of learning that is an essential component of art in its own right. So every artist is a student permanently. And I think it's interesting to think about that role of the teacher injecting himself into that process of perpetual learning that the artist is essentially committed to, whether there's a teacher there or not.
Well, I think it's always a case of self-educating.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That the student is trying to figure something out. Mm-hmm. And the first time he draws the table, the four legs are going out in different directions. And right. Can't get that perspective, right?
That's
but he's trying to figure it out, and he's trying to see what's right in front of his face. And the teacher just helps him when he's at that point of getting it to see what's right in front of his face. So we are facilitators to a learning process that's already going on with this. If the student isn't already, you know, trying to figure it out himself, they're just going to memorize stuff and give it back to you.
Yeah.
But if he's already trying to figure it out, you just give him that little push and he figures it out.
And of course, anything that you learn, you remember. Anything that you're taught, you haven't learned until something else happens and then you've learned.
Especially for artists. You learn more by doing.
Yeah.
Rather than by reading a book or something. I mean, you can learn by doing it that way, but it's better to, even if you just watch a videotape of somebody doing something, you can learn more.
Right.
But a workshop is much better, I think.
Right.
So if you teach in that way, and I think you teach that way, because both Bill and I teach pretty much the same way, that you participate with them, you know.
Yeah.
And participating with a student is different than teaching them. Because you're inspiring them and you're working with them.
Right.
And you have to learn, you know, it's very delicate. It's a very delicate, especially if they're younger. It's a very delicate situation because they, you know, catch on.
The authority is so huge.
Yeah. But you just have to be, you know, you just kind of lead them, and then you don't want to lead them too far because then you've done all the work for them.
Right.
And they have to do it themselves. So, you know, I always like this thing that, you know, from Maharshi, which is this idea about self-referral.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically, as Bill was saying earlier, is that, you know, it's all about them. It's not about me as their teacher or Bill as their teacher or this as their teacher.
Mm-hmm.
It's about them and them gaining the appreciation and understanding to be able to resolve what they're doing.
And there's a a subtle issue that comes to mind because I've experienced it outside of the domain of teaching more than in the area of teaching. And it actually, I refer to it crudely as the Arjuna principle. If you read the great Indian literature known as the Bhagavad Gita, It's essentially the teaching of God to a disciple on this battlefield. And the thing that's intriguing about it is that God has incarnated in the form of this great warrior's charioteer, and he's got all the answers, and he doesn't offer them.
Right.
And Arjuna, the warrior, is having more and more trouble reconciling all of the conflicting motives of someone about to go into war, and he doesn't know what to do, and he becomes increasingly immobilized by indecision. And Krishna doesn't tell him what to do. He knows that he needs to know what to do, and he knows that he can tell him exactly what he needs to know. Mm-hmm. But he doesn't. And what he does do is, and Maharshi points this out very nicely in his commentary on the Bhagavad Gita, but what Krishna does do is he refers to Arjuna by his wife's family name. Right. And that reminds Arjuna even more graphically that he's about to go into war and be killing members of his wife's family. Yeah. And that just puts him completely into paralysis, and he finally says, I don't know what to do. I'm damned if I do and damned if I don't. What should I do? At which point Krishna says, I'm glad you asked. And then he lays out the whole story.
Yeah, the whole story.
But what I've found in life in general is that if you know something that someone else needs to know, and they haven't picked up on it yet, and it doesn't mean you know more than they do, it just means that particular thing, you've had some experience that they haven't had. But I've found that if you push that knowledge onto them before they ask for it, what often happens is they listen to it and they think, nah, that doesn't fit. And they put it in the back of their mind in a room where rejected ideas are stored. Mm-hmm. So then later on, when their natural experience in life leads them to that recognition, that realization, they recognize it and they think, oh, yes, I had that thought before. It's back there in the room of rejected ideas. So it's I've already rejected it. Mm. And so they miss it. You're actually doing them a disservice by trying to push information onto them that they don't actually want yet.
Right. Right.
And in the teaching context, I think this thing is happening on a tiny scale throughout the whole process.
Every moment.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting that you bring it up, because it seems to me it's about discovery.
Yeah.
It's about discovery. Because if you're discovering something and that idea comes from you, mm-hmm. you know, there's two sides to the creative process. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what Matisse said, he said it's 80% inspiration and 20% perspiration. And people think, well, what does he mean? And what's it's like, does that mean I'm gonna do artwork? I'm gonna, you know. It's a lot of work to be. You have to have a really good work ethic. Mm-hmm. But the inspiration is that it's really key. It's really, really key. So there's mm-hmm. these two sides. So if the person can be figuring things out and kind of gaining or appreciating or understanding or finding information within themselves,
yeah.
that when that happens, and you'll remember, they get excited.
Oh yeah,
I can sure. do this. Or I can do this. So there's the, you know, there's the work side of creativity, and then there's the discovery and gaining energy and all of those different kinds of things.
It's
the marriage.
Response.
Yeah. It's the marriage between those two things. So it's mm-hmm. trying to teach them so that they can be discovering all the time, which they're doing anyway, as long as they're looking at the artwork.
Yeah.
They just don't know it.
Yeah.
You know?
I think it may have been Da Vinci who said, we walk by dint of falling forward. Mm. And in a sense, what the teacher is doing is digging little holes in front of the student as he walks so that he can continue falling forward, creating this little vacuum of understanding that pulls your attention in the right direction.
Yeah, right.
So that you, the student, have the realization, instead of just being handed the realization, which makes it not a realization and nothing more than info.
Right.
And of course, physiologically, recognition and the aha response produce endorphins. They create long-term memory. They make things memorable, and they make you feel really good. They produce interhemispheric coherence. And I have a whole theory of how music works that's based on this.
It's the same as art.
Exactly the same. Well, and music is providing this in the field, in the temporal domain. Mm-hmm. It's giving you these different time scales of recognition, mm-hmm. where you get to recognize a pitch that you heard before. You get to recognize a sequence of pitches, a fragment of a melody. You get to recognize the orchestration being repeated. You get to recognize the thematic color of the chords and the chord progressions. And it's the repetition of these things on all these different scales, ranging from just frequency, where we're talking about thousandths of a second, to whole segments of a sonata form symphony, which may last 10 or 15 minutes per segment, or even recognition of the style of a composer, or recognizing the style of a genre, or mm-hmm. or a cultural, you know, collection of musical work. Every different level of recognition produces a little bit of endorphin, a little bit of delight. And the physiology is wired for that. It's designed to make us recognize things.
Discover.
It's natural discovery and learning.
Recognition is recognizing the self.
That's right.
Realization is the final kind of crowning achievement of that physiological imperative that's built right into us.
Discovery. It's really important, because I mean, what are you discovering? You know, you're discovering yourself. You're discovering parts about yourself. And that's something that's really interesting, I think, about the creative process, is that, you know, we many, many times will get involved in things creatively so that we can dig ourselves out, because we know we can. We don't know how we can do it, but we know we can get involved in this huge, big thing that may take years to do. We don't know what it's going to look like in the end, but we have the conviction that we will be able to do it. And it's that conviction which is based on that thing of the self-referral and having that, because we know we can do it. We know we can resolve this thing. Having that go all the way through, and then you're discovering how you're doing it along the way. It's just adding, you know, wonderful fun.
But that's just the artist's voyage of discovery.
Yes,
thrill and aha and the fulfillment comes from him, because if you knew, you know, it's just rote turning out of stuff. If you just know exactly what the next one's going to look like, and you just make another one, that's no fun. The artist wants to set a goal and solve the riddle. The whole story.
Because otherwise, you know, it's like, you know, when you make an artwork, when you're done, you pull out. And then I tell people, I'm just a viewer now. You know, I look at it just like you do. I'm done with it. But what have I gained? What have I gained by virtue of that? It's almost indescribable. You know, everything that I learned, you know, the whole different things about how I became a better artist and all these different situations, that's mine. The artwork, you could take it and burn it if you wanted to.
It's a symptom of a process. It's a side effect.
But also, it's a mysterious process.
Absolutely.
You have control over only so far.
That's right.
And usually when a work goes to a transcendental level of like a what we might call very fine art, it's when you as an artist have faith
that
everything you've put together is going to work, and you watch your hand do it, and that's a mysterious thing. And if you try to get involved there and control, it comes back to a kind of like more of a mundane level, and that thing that when you're done and you look at it, like you said, and if you wonder, how did I do that? I didn't do that. It's brilliant. And I mean, sometimes it is, sometimes it isn't, but when it is, it's usually the result of this process. You don't quite know how you did it. And then how do you teach that? You know, my feeling in teaching is I teach beginning, and I teach advanced, and I don't teach intermediate. Because beginning, you always want the student to be a beginner.
Right.
That's this voyage of discovery stuff, always learning. And then advanced has to do with this mystery level of it. The other is how to paint a good painting, so you have control over the whole way. Well, you could teach that, but it's not as interesting to me as pumping the always a beginner, and then sort of in some kind of a way conveying this stepping back, surrendering, and watching yourself do it, and the mystery of creating great art.
When I think about something that I've created that I knew at the beginning was an absolutely black, empty void. And yet somehow there was something there, and what was there was nothing other than intent. And that Ashtanga Kash installation at Gallery 51 was the most glaring example of it in my experience, where I needed a way to direct sound to one or another of eight speakers in the installation, and I wanted that to be under my control. And so I needed some kind of sound distributor. Mm. And having been into digital electronics, I thought, well, I'll, you know, get a little microprocessor and set up a little thing with solid state relays and write a little program and stick it behind the curtain. And then I thought, no, that's totally wrong. This is an installation. It's in a gallery. It's for people to look at. So it should be fun. So you have to make a machine that distributes the sound. You can't make a little solid state thing and hide it. You got to make something people can look at. And I thought, I have no idea, when I first began thinking about that, what it will be. Mm. Absolutely not. All I know is I need one, and I don't know what it looks like. I don't know how it works. I don't know what kind of technology is involved. I'm completely blank. And yet I knew that somehow I could do it.
You pull it off, yeah.
And the somehow is where the magic is. That's right. I don't know where it comes from. Yeah. If I write a poem, I don't know where each word is coming from. In this case, though, it's something really tangible and really objective and really obvious once it's done. And yet I still have to say, you know, there's this period. Actually, I mean, it's a sequence of problem solving. And each one you look at and you think, well, I need a motor that'll keep this thing turning that doesn't mind if it's prevented from turning. But it has to always be trying to turn. And I can't use a spring because it's got to go all day long. Mm-hmm. And how do you do that? And then, you know, gradually little solutions come to mind. And I realize that, you know, the little fan on the back of a computer is turning all the time. Mm-hmm. And if you stall it, it's still trying to turn. You pull your finger out of the blades and it starts turning
again. Starts up again, yeah.
And so I got a, you know, I got a fan and tried that. And that worked, except that after a while it got hot and melted. So I ran it on half power. Mm. And it didn't get hot and melt. And it worked fine. Mm. But one thing led to another, and they all came out of nothingness. Mm. And it's just sort of a more coarse example, or more large scale or tangible example, of the same thing that's happening when you're applying the brush to the canvas, or another phrase in the poem comes to mind. Where does it come from? You don't know. You don't get to see it come out of nothing. Mm-hmm. But you do get a very clear sense of the nothing that it came out of. And I think that's part of what makes the creative process wonderful.
It's the magic of the cosmic mind and our connection with it, because you have the intention.
That's it. Yeah.
You place
that's
the it. Attention yeah. And then let go. It's like sanyama.
Yeah, that's right.
And then this larger computer that we're connected to starts computing and gives us the answer. We don't figure it out at all.
Yeah.
It's a magical process.
Yeah, and it's the most elegant one for that specific set of parameters that you're trying to resolve.
Yeah.
You know? So there's that sense of, and when it's perfect and you know it's perfect, and then it's like, oh yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Then you do the little dance, you know, when you're done with the picture, you know, you do the little dance.
Right. And you say, if I existed, I did that.
What the thing is that it exists, though. That's the thing that's really interesting. Yeah. You stop and think about it. Because when you've balanced everything and you've sorted everything out and you've worked on it and you've taken all these opposite qualities from tone to texture to color to, and all that gets in there and it all gets all sorted out, and then this magic comes in, you have that. And then when we said earlier that you pull out, and then, you know, you have this finished thing. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to think about that finished thing, you know, because Bill Witherspoon, who's a dear friend, he had an exhibit at MUM Remember when he went and he was doing, he went way out and he was doing the watercolor paintings, and he brought back the stones, and he had the stones in him, and then he put them, he did some paintings where he put a Sri Yantra that he wrote everything out, and he put it behind the painting so you would never see it. Mm-hmm. And then he invited, you know, I love Bill's mind, the way it works. He invited a bunch of blind people to come in and have them come in and pick which paint, and they always would pick the one with the yantra in it. Wow. So you couldn't see what was there, but it was still affecting you. So it's interesting to think that, you know, we put so much of our time and our attention and our self into creating these artworks that they actually, they exist. They have their own existence. Mm-hmm. And then I always think that any time someone looks at that and they enjoy it, who gets the benefit of that? Mm-hmm. You ever thought of that? We do, as the artist, because we're the creator. So anything that we create that's beautiful or wonderful or, you know, whatever, wherever it goes, it's generating something. Just like Bill Witherspoon's painting, it's generating something because it is in existence. And it does have a balance. It does have a unity, which is at the source of its power, if you want to think of it in that way. Mm-hmm. So it's generating something. So it's a kind of an interesting thing that, you know, and that's what people pick up on, that magic, you know, when they go to a museum. And I'll take my students to a museum and I'll say, well, how many of you have looked at artworks and you become weak in the knees? Or you can't talk? Or your breath will stop? Or you'll start to cry? Mm-hmm. And they've had these experiences. You know, you go to the museum and people have these experiences. Yeah. And I said, well, then think about that. You know, consider that. How did that happen? Why did that happen? Mm-hmm. You know, it's worthwhile to kind of try to figure it out how that happened.
Yeah.
But it's true. I mean, though, same with music or same, you know, with anything. As long as it has that underlying kind of quality, and there's this, you know, for lack of a better word, this incredible unity that exists within that balance, mm-hmm. you'll have that experience, that, you know, that kind of, whoa, my God.
There's also this rare opportunity to put something that contains a piece of yourself out into the world where anything could happen to it, and possibly something positive comes back. I mean, I don't create the art that I do for other people.
No.
But when I'm done with something, there's nothing I like better than for someone to get it and tell me they liked it.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's a total ego stroking experience, but it sort of completes the loop. Mm-hmm. The creativity and care that I put into it, suddenly someone is, you know, recharging that battery for me.
Yeah, they appreciate it.
But it's a communion.
Yeah.
On the subtle.
Yes, yes.
That's why the arts are such a significant part of culture.
And that's why people who perform in Fairfield get so blown away by the experience of the Fairfield audience, because people are putting their full attention on what the performer is doing instead of 10% of their attention. And the full attention of somebody who's well rested and alert and paying good, you know, wide awake, is very different from the full attention of a tourist who just breezed into New York and is sitting in the 50th row of a gigantic theater. And we've had people, I guess I've probably said this too many times already on the show, but we've had people who perform in New York on a regular basis tell us that a half full house at the Sondheim here in town is more meaningful to them than a full house on Broadway. That what they get from it is people who are really connecting with what they're doing. And you can almost see it in the theater when someone is performing and the audience is loving it and the performer is feeding off of that energy and putting more out, and they're feeding off of what he's putting out and feeding it back. And that loop just creates something between the performer and the audience.
Yeah, but that's art too. Before. You know, that's art
Absolutely.
And that's, I think that's important. And that's, you know, trying to get back to this thing about teaching, you know, that's what we have to engender in the students.
Absolutely.
Is that.
Yeah. And even if their parents want the grape, the vase with the grapes, you know, because they've got this idea of what they want to see. Yeah. You've got to teach this. You've got not only to teach the students and have them make this voyage of discovery, even if it ends up that they're making something that we didn't expect.
Right.
And then you have to educate the parents a little bit too, right, as to what education.
And of course, it's
about
something we didn't expect. You know, that's, why wouldn't it be? And there's this other thing, the continuum between the beginner, as you were talking about, and the person who's now actually an artist and looking to pursue it more deeply. There's this strange area in between, filled, especially in the visual arts, filled with technique, probably all the arts. And I'm reminded of the woman I saw interviewed on television a year or so ago, I think it was 60 Minutes, who lives in China and does oil paintings on commission from a distributor in China who sells them to a distributor in China who sells them to people in the U.S. who order them for $50. And you send them a photograph, and this girl paints an oil painting that copies the photograph. And she isn't an artist. She doesn't even like what she does. To her, it's an exercise. It's a physical task that she's required to do, and she doesn't really much care for it.
It's a job.
Yeah.
Well, anyone can learn to copy.
Yes.
Yeah. And that's what
this technique mastered.
I know.
And that beginning part and the end part are missing. It's just the middle. Technique.
Right. But it's the it's a trap of artists.
Sure.
I've been through it. I think all of us have to go through this
deep trap
that we get stuck in virtuosity. Technique.
Yeah.
And we lose that. Oftentimes, the crudest earlier work that we do has more
soul
and the virtuosity.
Yeah.
We feel that we have to show that off. We have to be a real one. We have to be a bona fide. And so we start being drawn into this showing off our virtuosity.
Right.
And we can often lose our soul that way.
Yeah. Right.
Listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.